all your database or belong to us.
Hey, this is a highly technical episode of Geek Speak. Please enjoy. You might want to bring a pen and pencil. And this is Miles Elam in the house with me. Hey, Miles.
The lights just dimmed. It's kind of this whole intimate, like,
yeah, baby.
You'll never find.
And now you have a music story for us. Tell us about Sonos.
So Sonos makes speakers. Now, they
smart
make
speakers, right?
They make smart speakers. And these smart speakers, like many other smart devices, requires a connection to the internet.
Boo. I mean, I'm sorry. First off, you better be doing a lot more than being a speaker to have a connection to the internet. I mean, come on. I mean, the other thing they're doing, of course, is that you can say, hey, go play Pandora for me. It'll start playing your library. It'll look on local computers and stream. It basically is like all the music smarts of your laptop or your phone in a dedicated device. It also has a speaker, which is a good speaker.
Right.
And they're expensive, right?
They are. The thing here is that when you buy something, chances are, especially when you're used to buying a speaker, you're thinking like, hey, I bought this. I'm done. Right. However, Sonos, because this is a smart device and it connects to the internet, they're going to have a privacy policy.
Yeah.
So whoever thought of like getting a privacy policy for your speaker? Like household appliances, you don't really think about it. But once they make that connection out, there needs to be some type of policy.
It protects you at some level as well, theoretically.
Theoretically. Sonos.
I can't even say that with a straight face.
Sonos is changing their privacy policy. Now, what happens if they want to change that privacy policy after you've already purchased your speaker?
Well, Miles, if you read the original policy, it says they have the right to change the policy anytime they damn well please.
We are altering the bargain. Pray I don't alter it further.
Take the princess and the Wookiee to my ship.
You said they'd be left in the city under my supervision.
I am altering the deal. Pray I don't alter it any further.
The customers don't have to acknowledge that privacy statement. But once they do, that customer won't be able to update the software on their system. Over time, if you don't update the software, if they decide to change what the communication channel is because that device requires an internet connection,
yep,
it will cease to function. The device that you've already purchased will one day just stop working.
So basically you're forced to either accept the policy or get another speaker.
Yes. Which was not cheap to begin with.
I want to know, I mean, okay, speaker one thing, right? But I've never had like an intimate connection with a speaker. Like for me, it's never been that way. Mm-hmm. Even though I've got an Echo, right? I mean, I just don't have that. I'm mostly frustrated at that thing.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm thinking like when it gets to the point where it's something you like don't think would ever be needed that way. Like your shoes, you know, let's say you buy some shoes.
Mm-hmm.
And it happens to have a step tracker in them, right, built in that
sure.
syncs and stuff. And then one day you're like, yeah, you can't use your shoes anymore. And you're thinking, well, I'll just use them without the step tracker. But no, they just don't function anymore. They get hot and burn your feet. Like fail completely to work.
Right. I think of this from the point of view of I have an iPad 1, the original one.
God, do you have Netflix installed in that?
I do.
I kind of hate you.
We haven't watched Netflix on it for quite some time.
Thank you. No, I'm just kidding. The thing that's funny about that, of course, is that we don't update that app anymore.
Right. Right.
So
it is stuck on iOS 5.3, 5.1. I forgot what the...
But you can watch Netflix on the device, right?
I can, yeah.
I used to work on that app. And when I left that app, we kind of sat there, and there was like a call to make a change on it. Months and months later, I'd heard about it, and I was like, oh, I hope it's not going to be me. It was my buddy David that had to do it. I was like, ha-ha.
Right, but it is stuck on a specific iOS version. Now, they're not making any updates to the operating system, and the SDK has moved on, so most companies, like, they
can't do anything, really.
You would have to get sometimes even an older Mac to have an older version of Xcode.
I'm pretty sure you can't deploy a change to the actual app anymore, and I don't think you can download that anymore. Do not erase that device. I don't think you can get the app anymore. Like it's
no, the Apple changed that. You can get the most up to date version of a particular app that works
that
on
matches
that
your
OS.
Operating system?
Yeah. for all intents and purposes, Apple has stopped support for it. They have like some minor things, like you can technically connect to the App Store, but none of the apps, none of the new apps,
right,
go for it. Like what you had 3 years ago was what you got. That's that's it. And at the same time, even if Apple decided to stop all communication with it, if I decided to turn the iPad to be, you know, to block Apple servers, it still works.
Yeah.
Maybe Netflix wouldn't support it anymore. I don't know. But like that's an individual app might not stop working. But the overall device still works. So the things that don't require a network connection, the drawing app for my daughter, or, you know, the note-taking app, you know, something like that,
sure,
or, you know, taking photos. That would still work in perpetuity. As long as the device still powers up, that still works.
Yeah.
This notion that you can buy things,
right,
that will arbitrarily, from your point of view, arbitrarily stop working at some point in the future. Is
the iPad not needing to phone home and work, and it just keeps on working and working and working,
mm-hmm,
which is like a complete computer versus a speaker, and the speaker doesn't work. That just seems totally unfair.
Right.
Like Sonos is obviously doing something kind of wrong if it requires a phone home.
Yeah.
Do you have any security cameras in your home?
I don't.
I
mean, I might.
Yeah, I've got lots of them. And I live in Paris, France. yeah, so the speaker thing, I've got like one of those traditional alarms, which is just really kind of dumb. I mean, it phones home and all that crap. But it doesn't have like the camera. And of course, I don't want the camera from the security perspective because, wow, you got footage of a stranger stealing stuff. What are you going to do with that? Give it to the police? They're not going to do anything with it. But the have a dog at home and the, you know, general being aware of the house, mm-hmm, I've kind of always wanted those. When we had the chicken, I wanted a chicken cam, right? So I could, you know, check a look at the chickens. Yeah. But, you know, when in
look, dumb birds.
Dumb birds doing dumb things. I love watching chicken TV. Anyway, when I started researching the cameras, there's no way you can find a camera that's any good, right? They're going to have bad quality. They're going to have required internet service. They're going to phone home. They're going to be a security vulnerability. It's just like inviting a lot of pain for yourself if you're, mm-hmm, going to deal with that. And this is the same kind of thing.
The big botnets that are out there are those security cameras.
I've been very close to getting Sonos speakers because of the desire to be able to play different audio. I think you can play Google Play music from a Sonos, right? But you can't do it from Alexa. And so I thought about buying them. And I also, of course, think, well, I'll just grab a Raspberry Pi and then I'll grab one of those little cool amplifiers. I'll put my own speaker. Like building it myself kind of sounded more compelling than dealing with the security vulnerabilities of having a smart device, right, in my home.
One, building it yourself becomes fun. Like you're learning something. Yeah. It's like you're tinkering. There's an aspect to that that still appeals to me.
I would rather build my own speaker system with a Raspberry Pi than play golf. Absolutely. Like 100%. And no offense to golf. It's more interesting to me to solve a problem.
Oh, I'll offend golf.
You'll offend golf?
Yeah. My dad had me take lessons when I was younger.
I've got some
baggage.
Wait, baggage? You mean clubs?
I see what you're driving at.
Oh, God.
All right. This conversation's putting
that was
along.
Like a birdie. What? Can we go on? Are you doing so? Sonos is going to cease to function if you don't say yes to the new.
Potentially,
yeah. What are they changing the policy? We get your firstborn? I mean, is it really bad?
Well, who knows? But the idea is that a lot of times when you purchase something, even if it has some agreement, it's like this is the agreement. We're buying this thing and this is the deal. This is the contract that we're running by. That a company can unilaterally change that policy, not for a general service, because this is where the line is drawing. If I'm with a phone company and the phone company changes their policies,
you're paying a weekly service. Makes sense, right?
It's a monthly service. Yeah, it's ongoing service.
You stop buying that service from them.
It's a different.
But if you buy a $600 speaker and 2 months later the policy changes such that you don't like it, that's not good.
Right. I mean, they're not going to give you a refund for that.
All right. You've got one more story about AT&T's internet service.
Yes. That being that AT&T has been getting few complaints to the FCC because they appear to be discriminating on the neighborhood. For example, in one major one metropolitan area, the wealthy neighborhood will get very fast speeds. The poor neighborhood will get the introductory 1.5 megabit per second speed and then charging it. So these very different tiers. And you end up with a furthering of the digital divide.
Wait, why are they doing that?
From a business standpoint, you go, what is the buying power of one area? What is the buying power for another? And, you know, what is the rate of uptake on
those tiers? Oh, you mean saying so therefore in one neighborhood, they don't put it in the higher gear because they're not going to get as good a return. So you have neighborhood A that makes $100,000 a year, and you have neighborhood B that makes $50,000 a year. And neighborhood A, you invest more resources in because you can get more money out of it than neighborhood B. Okay, I got it. Well, I mean, it makes sense from a business perspective. I thought they were doing something even more devious of
There are a lot of things that make sense from a business perspective, but at the same time, for example, in this country, 130 years ago? I don't know, whatever. Maybe it's just 100 years ago that there was a policy where we're going to set up telephones and everyone's going to have telephone service. Or here's one that's much earlier than that is the postal service.
Mm-hmm.
That if you
that's very early. That's like founding the country early.
Yes. If you have an address, we are going to deliver to you.
Right.
That's actually why a stamp costs as much as it does today, is because they're not just delivering to the major metropolitan areas. They're delivering to a lot of these way off
places. Dude, a stamp does not cost a lot of money.
They do in aggregate. But, I mean, I think about from the point of view of what they cost when we were younger and things become
it's
more efficient.
It's less than a buck, right?
Yes. Oh, sure. Yeah.
You can send something from the West Coast to the East Coast for less than a buck. That's not expensive. More than that, you can say you can pick some town and send it to that zip code with the person's name, and it'll get to their.
My point being that 46 cents, or actually, I don't remember.
That's a good guess. I think that's what it is. But go ahead.
Will pay for a letter to go from one coast to the other. But actually, paying for getting from New York to Los Angeles costs much less than that. It's the cost of getting it to Hawaii or getting it to Anchorage that costs. That was actually not even so much Anchorage, getting much further north to like Nome, Alaska. That's where things get, you know, dicier and much more expensive to go out there just because fewer letters going out there plus the distance involved. But it was important at the time. So it was important that you shared the
40 stamps is $25 right now. Yeah.
It was important to share that cost because you wanted to have those communication lines open. It was a net benefit that society could communicate with one another. You didn't have these tiered areas that were just inaccessible. And if you've ever, for example, I think of letters that my sister mailed me when she was visiting in Brazil. She came back from her vacation before her letters did. We were wondering what happened to her. Like, oh my God, do we need to go down to Brazil to try to find my sister? And she comes back like, what? I send a letter to you like once a week. You know, like, oh. 2 weeks later, the letters start arriving, and we're like, oh,
how did you get on the stamp and postal department?
Sorry,
because it was infrastructure investment.
Yes.
Okay, go on. Connect this back to the story about how
so now
awesome AT&T is.
So now we send emails much more so than – at least I send them far more often than I do a physical mail.
Yeah.
Most people, I think, do. And internet connectivity has become that basic communication line.
Yeah.
Now, sure, if you want to send a whole bunch of letters, if you want to send something in bulk, it costs more. But just getting on that honor, just that basic introductory, that is where that's where I'm talking about.
Yeah, I get that.
That and foundation.
The only thing to say, though, about that is that they are providing a 1.5 megabits per second connection, which is pitifully slow.
How well does that do with YouTube or Netflix?
The point is that it does function from an email perspective. I mean, it's slow.
Yes, from an email perspective.
Yeah.
But how are we learning a lot of times? A lot of times we'll go online and we'll see something from YouTube, and that's how. So a lot of tutorials aren't even written down anymore.
And I get
they come in the form of video.
And the truth of the matter is, the reason why we have the postal service, the reason why we have the telephone service, was because the country invested a major amount in building that infrastructure, not a telco, right? I mean, it is true that the telco company did it, but they got tax incentives from the government. The government paid for it.
Right.
Or, you know, subsidized it. severely, and that's why it works.
But AT&T, in being a provider in many of these areas for internet, has made the deal to say we are going to be the provider in exchange for these subsidies and benefits provided by the local, state, and federal government.
Sure, sure.
And that's why the complaint is coming to the FCC going, hey, wait a second. You said that you would provide
so a certain layer. Is a complaint to the FCC, and the FCC is looking into it.
Yes.
Of course, the current administration, they probably won't do anything about it.
Almost certainly not. Yeah.
All right. Well, is that it? Was anything else you wanted to talk about during the week or anything? Are you enjoying being employed?
That's a mixed bag.
Because you're busy now, I'm assuming.
Well, I like my job. I'm not trying to take away from that. This is a conversation I had with a coworker, actually, which was they were asking me if I was having fun. And I don't think of jobs that way. If any of us were independently wealthy, we're working, we're optional, many of us would still work.
Yeah.
But would we be working where we are now, doing what we do now?
I probably,
most likely not.
I might.
Okay.
I really like my job, but you're right that it, you know, I have to think about that.
And of all the previous jobs you've had, was that also what you would do?
No. Okay. Well, you know, I don't know. I mean, I've always been in a situation where I enjoyed doing what I was doing, but I think that's about making sure that I'm not motivated by money.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you're motivated for that financial gain, you're always looking at it as just a dollar, then your emotional intent doesn't get behind it, and it's hard to get engaged and start to flounder.
Finding interest in something, like finding interest in things I'm working on, that hasn't been a problem per se. But when someone talks about like, hey, are you really happy there? It's like, I think there's this lack of recognition of it's a job.
I
saw something on LinkedIn. This is actually what I want to talk about because it was something that really honestly pissed me off. LinkedIn sends me news stories from LinkedIn and it doesn't matter how many times.
I just ignore them.
Yeah. It doesn't matter how many times I tell it unsubscribe, they still keep sending them to me. I'm about to set a filter up. But at any rate, it was talking about what they called a work spouse.
What?
So if you...
Sorry, it just sounds offensive.
I
what
know,
is a work
but,
spouse?
But that person that you work with, you have a close collaboration with, and you are able to... You know, a partnership to get things done.
It's called
and to
a colleague. It's not called a work spouse.
Yeah, but they were talking about you have colleagues, but then you have that one special person, that buddy that, you know.
Okay.
And
I don't have
everything
that,
about that description was like, yeah, all that talk about work-life balance, that is completely contrary to that.
Yeah, that sounds ridiculous. Was the story that that's a healthy way to be in a business? Or was it, be careful if you think of your partners?
No, it was a way to be more productive with the company and be more engaged with the company. I don't think that being disengaged with your company is a good thing.
No.
But a corporation, a company is not...
A family.
Yeah.
No, definitely.
It's not family. It's not friend.
I think that's actually one of our slides at Netflix. It's not a family. Though I have to say, like, to respond to whether I'm having fun or not, I actually have a colleague that asks his like opening line every time you see him is having fun, which is aggravating eventually. I should probably bring it up. But in any case, there is something that I do in general in my life that allows me to be engaged in things at my full potential, and that is to – I endeavor to be committed to the things that I'm in, both with my time but also with my passion. So when I do something, I don't want to be doing it because I'm doing it, right? I want to be doing it because I'm enjoying doing it. And so I would say that I hack myself such that I'm that way, right?
The overall tasks I'm working on right now are engaging.
You're programming.
Yes.
And working
I like
with colleagues
them.
And stuff.
However, I also have to write unit tests and integration tests.
You don't like writing those?
All right.
You don't need unit tests if you have good enough integration tests. That's my philosophy.
So if you don't have a programming background, the idea is that you have these tests that
– Even
that
if you have a programming background, the idea is – go on.
The idea is you have software. You want to make sure that it works the way it does. So how are all the different ways that you would use the software? And you would write automated tests for that. So that every time you make it,
you write other little programs that run against your main program and right. check what it does.
Right.
So it's like doubling your work. But if you ever need to change anything or do anything, and you have this whole suite of applications that check your main application, if you change the main application and one of them goes, hey, it's not working right,
right.
you know that you did something wrong in the main application.
Right. You actually, in all the studies that have shown this, if you write tests ahead of time and you're writing along with the software, that you end up coding faster overall.
Right, much faster.
Because, one, you catch errors quickly. Mm-hmm. And catching errors quickly is always cheaper and more time efficient than later.
But also you can make changes faster.
Yes, because you have a comfort level to say, I'm changing this. The tests still work for the inputs and outputs. It works.
Right. So we have three types of tests that we do at Netflix. We've got unit tests, mm-hmm. which a unit test, the best way to describe that is you have a small feature of the application and it completely stand alone. You can test mm-hmm. it. A good way to do this, let's say we had a little program that multiplied two numbers. So all you do is you write some test cases that gives it like 500 different pairs of numbers and the results and check to see if they're the same. Mm-hmm. So that's a unit test because all you need is your little program and that set of tests and you know if it works or not. And if you have good coverage, you know, you've kind of encapsulated all the things it could do. And then integration tests. You want to describe integration tests?
Well, I was actually thinking of a nice analogy which fits with our environment right now. You have some headphones. Mm-hmm. And you want to test, do the headphones work? And so you have something that just puts some tones in. You listen to it. Do the tones come out? Do they come in at a reasonable fidelity? Are they the right note? Mm-hmm. Ah, okay. There's my unit test. It's a headphone just by itself.
Right.
And then we have our microphones.
Our integrate, yes.
Right. And the microphones, you're testing and saying, like, you make
if
a sound.
If I play a tone on the speaker yeah, up to the microphone.
Do they come out, you know, yeah. the same thing that you would have with the headphones, just in the reverse. And you have our recording device. You know, is it actually recording any inputs that come into it? Those were all unit tests. Now let's plug them all together. If I'm speaking into the microphone and listening into the headphones, can I hear my own voice and is it being recorded
onto the recording device, yeah.
and can I get it back out? So, that's an integration test. Does everything
so
work together?
Integration test obviously is a lot more complicated. And one of the things I was kind of jokingly earlier is if you wrote all the tests necessary for integration tests of these microphones, headphones, you wouldn't actually need a unit test because if it all worked, you knew the speakers were, you knew the headphones worked, you knew the microphone worked, and so on. But of course, you can't really do that because the problem space gets very large for integration tests. Mm-hmm. There's also UI tests, and we think of those different. Those are normally actually integration tests as well, but they're slightly different. They're kind of emulating what a user would do in a certain scenario. Mm-hmm. And that, of course, is very important when you're dealing with a complicated user interface application, something like Netflix. Even though it sounds like Netflix is – I remember before I started Netflix, I thought Netflix is really simple. Like it's just, you know, a list of movies and they play. And now that I write the thousands and thousands of lines of software just to do one little feature, I'm totally aware that it's actually a much more complicated structure. But we have unit tests, though I've never written a unit test at Netflix because I just end up not doing a lot of the library kind of stuff. And when I say library stuff – oh, actually, I guess I have written unit tests. Almost never. But integration tests, we do a lot of this. And what we're actually doing is testing the entire flow of our data. So we have, you know, people in Los Angeles that take a film and they put it in our system. They give it a title and they give it a genre and all this information about the title, including pictures and video, you know, trailers and things of that nature. And then we, in the group that I'm in, we grab those titles and we present them in new ways to the user, you, mm-hmm. To show like an interesting new row or a big billboard on the top of the application that highlights something like a new show is coming out in 3 days, and so we show you a billboard that has a countdown. And all of that relies heavily on the data being accurate that's put into the system. But when we talk about the data being put in the system, we actually get it from some external company, and then it has to be translated into 17 different languages, and all the strings and all the images and everything has to be translated that way.
Only 17?
Well, I think we're doing 17. Maybe we're doing more. I never can keep track of it. The process of languages being turned on is actually automated at this point, so it's really we recently added Hebrew, which was a big deal for it because, of course, it's a right-to-left language and it's a popular language. In any case, the steps of confirming that data is valid is actually so complicated that it requires programmers to write tests for that. Mm-hmm. We call those functional tests, basically making sure that the data coming from the data store is in the format that our UIs can use them. And all the UIs use different pieces, and so we have tests that kind of match that. And then we have the UI tests, which is if you click on this button and this thing opens up, can you still play a movie? You know, and those mm-hmm. are a whole bunch that actually run on, for me, I do iOS development, they actually run on the iOS device itself, and you can actually, when the software is running, you can see the device actually operate like someone's operating it. And all of those we use in different ways. But I always joke that if we just had better unit tests, we wouldn't need to do anything else, because, of course, anyway. I'm not unit tests, sorry, UI tests. We're talking about, the one I want to ask you, though, is that you have been focused on raising your daughter and like being with her and being an awesome father and also being an awesome son to your father who passed away this mm-hmm. last year and being there for your mom and for his illness and just really dedicated to family life. And while you were doing that, you were also programming. Your programming mind was going. You were doing lots of things.
I wasn't while my father was alive, but after he passed, yeah, my brain
gets more time
back in. Yeah.
He was a full-time job. So in doing that, you were like reworking how we potentially could be rendering the GeekSpeak site in really cool new ways that I'm excited about, dealing with better compression algorithms for PNG, SVG tricks and such. So things that are in our space, we talk a bit about after the show and stuff about this kind of stuff. And then you get a job and you're working full-time for like 2 weeks now at least.
Mm-hmm.
And all of a sudden you spat out like two open source projects that you completed.
What? Except that they were written before I started working at the company. That was the thing.
So I totally get that. But why is it that you could have published those before when you didn't have a job, but that you published them when you had a job? How did that come about? Are you just more focused on software right now?
It's because I wanted to get them off my plate.
They felt like they were like nagging at you.
Right. When you don't have a deadline, it's really easy to put things off and go work on other things. When I'm unemployed, I'm like, I have a limited amount of time. This needs to get done or it's not going to get done. So, on a Sunday, I just like went, okay, what do I need to do to finish this off and then publish it?
Off your plate. And
yeah.
So you open source two things. One is like a C app that basically does conversion stuff. Can you describe what this thing does and why it was needed?
So a number is a number is a number in a computer.
Yes.
But the representation of it changes when it's exposed to human eyes. So that could be a binary, so a bunch of ones and zeros, a base 2 system, or it could be an octal system, which is base 8, so 0 through 7, base 10, which is what we normally interact with.
Sure.
And then base 16, so hexadecimal.
Sure.
And every time you increase that base number, you're increasing the number of distinct characters, but reducing the number of characters you need to be able to show a given number.
Okay.
So something that I've used on occasion in JavaScript is base 36, going from 0 through 9 and then going A through Z.
Okay.
So each distinct letter is...
What were you doing that for? So basically you're saying is you wanted to have a... Why were you doing that?
For example, if you're making an E tag, which is... a resource on the web to be able to uniquely identify the state of a page, for example.
Okay.
To say that this page has this signature.
Okay.
Aids in caching. You don't want it to be comprehensive. You don't want it really long because you want to compare against it quickly. You just want to say a sanity check. Yes, this hasn't changed.
So what you're saying is I publish one of the pages on GeekSpeak and I provide an e-tag, which is a metadata that's in the page that mm-hmm. the user doesn't see but a bot can see. And then if I ever update the page again, I just change that tag. Then a bot comes along. It already has
a server and a browser, but yeah.
Has a copy of this thing. And it goes, oh, this has changed. And so then because that number has changed, it doesn't have to do a diff and it has to cache the entire thing. It just sees the numbers change. And so then it gets the data and processes it again. Okay.
Right.
Got it. A cache busting kind of system.
Right. And it could do last modify. That's another way of doing it. But then you have to check the entire date, and date comparisons are always rife anyway. This was a very simple signature. Now, if I have a number like, 100,000. Actually, much better one would be like 1 million.
Okay.
there you have seven characters. You know, but that's a whole lot of wasted space. Like, that's a bite for everyone. It's not that big of a deal, but it's still, you have to iterate through seven characters to do that. If you put it in a base 36 system, then...
It's one character.
No. But 36 to the fourth power. Maybe it's four characters. I don't know. Something like that. I'd have to do the run the numbers right now to find out. But it's but at any rate, it's less than seven. Noticeably less than seven. So if I do 36 to the fourth power, that gives me 1.6 million. Yeah, so four characters would do
so, it. So what you're saying is that you want to have a number space a million long. If you're using decimals, you actually have to have the number a million, which
if,
takes
if I'm
you
doing a hash, I want the number
characters.
To be I want the number to be large enough that
it will be
distinct,
unique.
Yeah, it'll be at least unique enough.
Right. So what you're saying is that if you do it in just numbers, what we think of decimal numbers, then you have to have seven characters to hold a million. And if you do it in a base 36, meaning you use the characters 0 through 9, and then you use A through Z, you only have to have four characters
right.
to have the same same variation in numbers.
Right. And for human eyes looking at it,
it's
easier for me. Yeah,
four characters.
Yeah, fewer characters is easier
in
to
fact,
read.
In fact, I can almost definitely memorize that. I can't memorize a seven-digit number necessarily without some time, but I can memorize a four-digit number even if it has A's and B's and stuff because for me that...
Yeah, nowadays no one remembers phone numbers.
No.
Seven digits.
I sometimes remember them, but they don't know whose they are after I remember them.
But they always had common prefixes.
So that's one open source project. What? So basically what this thing does is what?
It allows you to take a number, any number that can be represented by the system, and convert that into whatever base you want. So I can say, I want that number in base 36. I want that number in base 48. I want that number in base 16.
Using numbers and then letters and
yes.
then what?
For numbers above base 36 or in formats that are over than that, you would use capital N lowercase.
Okay. Okay. So I see what you're saying. So this thing basically created these kind of fake number systems, basically.
Well.
I mean, hex is standard, but other things
hex
aren't.
Is none of these representations is any more fake than another. One, they're more less common than others. Like hexadecimal is very common in programming circles.
So you made a little library that would do this in C,
mm-hmm. and then parse the result. You know, so go back, say
and
like if you have a hexadecimal number, if you have a base 36 number, convert it back to a number that you can actually program with.
Okay. And the other project?
The other one is one I talked about on the previous post show, which was. Reading the file system and putting that into a database table.
So making a virtual table that's actually a read of a file structure.
Yeah, and PostgreSQL are referred to as foreign tables, foreign
data
wrappers.
Did you make that a pull request to the PostgreSQL system?
I'm not going to do that with the Python one. PostgreSQL, one of the big things about it is that it is portable to everything. I have PostgreSQL running on my Raspberry Pi. I have... You know, it runs on a Windows box. It runs on
anything. Windows too.
Yeah.
So go on.
Tool, while it's reading the file system, I'm replacing something that comes with the library called Multicorn, which did much the same thing, except that Python is not really great for input output and reading.
Was Multicorn done in Python?
Yes.
Okay, so you took a tool that already existed and modified it.
You can write extensions or foreign tables, foreign data wrappers, rather, in other languages like in C, but they're more error-prone. There's a lot more boilerplate. So some folks wrote it where they ported it to Python, and writing it in Python makes it much faster to deal with.
Because, of course, also you can find a Python derivative that will run on Linux and Windows and so on.
Right. The point behind it is to make it easy to attach to non-PostgreSQL systems to get data.
Right.
And
so
in
if
that,
you were
in
to,
that it made it cool.
So if you were to make it part of the core Python, I mean, core Postgres, you would have to write it in C and it would be a lot larger project.
Well, not just that. It would also need to do it in a portable way. What I had done was used a program called Find, GNU Find.
Oh, yeah, from Linux.
Right.
GNU, yeah.
So a Unix based one, and it has to be
you're
the
using
GNU
Find because it's fast.
Yes,
so
it is.
It's interesting. I had a colleague.
It is
of mine
two and a half orders of magnitude faster.
Yeah, I had a colleague that was trying to do something in the file system, and they were doing it. I believe they were doing it in Node, and I was like, "Just do that use Unix. Because you're on a Linux derivative, you know, a Unix derivative, you're on Linux. It's the best implementation of Fun faster, is already there.
It's faster to run Python to open up a pipe stream.
Sure.
To have the operating system do something, you know, run a program and run it and get back the results than for the programming language to do it itself.
You know, it's really funny. And of course, you can't do that from Postgres as well because Postgres also runs on Windows and Find isn't there.
Right. And I got
I'm sure there's some fine, but
I got a few more things. I added some more features into it since we're talking about it.
Yeah.
Where before it was you could find the file name, you could get patterns based upon that file name to, you know, because file names maybe they're a regular form, so you can say like the first part of it is the date, the second part is a name, file extension.
You're talking about the MP3s for GeekSpeak, aren't you?
Yes, I am. But also other things. But so things like that, file size, and you could also get the file contents. I made the mistake of doing a select on the file contents with the MP3s.
That's a lot of text.
Because I was going like, hey, what if I got just the first, you know, 30 bytes of the MP3s? And unfortunately, to do that, you have to pull the entire MP3, and then it does a substring.
Seriously? No, well, you've got to be able to do it from something.
Well, that's the thing. With PostgreSQL, it doesn't know what it needs ahead of time.
Yeah,
it was
well, because, of course, then you could also use those kind of magic signatures of file types to actually detect the file type extension if there was no extension.
Right. So when I used Find, things I got for free just because it was Find was what type of file system are you running on? Is it EXT4 or is it, you know, BetterFS?
Yeah.
What's the username and the group that it belongs to? What are the file permissions? Is it read-only or not? You know, like how many hard links, how many symbolic links, you know, what's the file size, but having it really fast. Let's see, what type of file is it? Is it a file? Is it a directory? Is it a symbolic link? Is
right.
it a special character, a special one? And then I was like, you know what? What if I could call out to external programs?
To do
because
what?
I was thinking, like, well, I want to read into the MP3s to read the metadata.
So
I want to see
call out to lame and ask for data.
Yes, exactly.
Oh, awesome.
So, for example, you can call the file command. The file command will find out the MIME type of it. So you can go like, well, this is a text file that is of this character encoding. You know, that type of thing. You know, and so it opened up these new avenues like, oh, I can actually read this data back and I can see like, oh, this MP3 does not have the same information as the database does. It is no longer a current one. It needs to be redone. Flag that.
Dude, a lot of the MP3 files do not sync with the database because Lyle makes them, you know? Jesus.
No, but you can know that immediately. Like, it could...
Yeah, I know that immediately. They all are different.
But, I mean, if you were saying to publish, you could know before the first initial publish that they were out of sync.
Well, no, better that. Let's get writing in there. Let's put the database and write the MP3 metadata. Because I'm always just copying from the site.
Right.
But I recently friggin' automated a process that I've been doing manually forever, which was so nice. Automator's a really cool app, by the way.
On Mac, yeah.
Yeah. This Python file extension database emulation system that works in Postgres. Where do you release that? Is this just on your GitHub page?
Yeah, it's on GitHub, yeah.
And then is there any what space would allow people to see that this exists? If I'm a Postgres person and I want to get some system that allows me to read files, you know, file data, how would I know to find your open source project?
Aside from the keywords that I put onto that project.
Oh, so just Google is basically what you're saying.
Yeah. And hopefully, like, you know, Google would be able to find it.
Yeah.
They do crawl GitHub. And I announced it on Twitter and Google Plus.
It's really funny that, I mean, the whole point of a database is to manage the data.
Yep.
And the system's in place such that it's very easy to store data, lots of it, index it, cross-reference it, mm-hmm. have meta information about it. And so you're using the file system to You're using a tool to translate the database instead of using its engine to use the file system as its data engine.
For some of the info.
Seems a little odd to do that. Why not just consume the data file structure into the database?
Why not just put MP3s into the database? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah. I'm asking that. First off, when we first started doing GeekSpeak, we were doing it with Apache and Cocoon, which is XML library.
Yeah.
And Postgres. We've always run with Postgres.
With Tomcat, yeah. Tomcat, Cocoon servlet, yeah.
And we were always using Postgres. And early on, we did have the images in the database.
Mm-hmm.
And you were like a high proponent of that. And it was a pain for me to deal with that.
Right, because we didn't have tools as well, like getting in and out.
I was writing the tools to deal with it. And then at one point I had to migrate. I had to get the data out. And it was really hard to get that data back out of the database. Thanks, Ruby. But that's what I used actually to get it out. And I open sourced that little library in case anybody had ever done that disaster. So I was very much into like put it on the file system, put large files in the file system. But now you're trying to kind of merge the two worlds. And it seems like, well, why not just suck them back into the database? I mean, it's not that – they're still being saved to the disk. Like there's something different about it, right? Why not put the large files in the database? There's probably binary fields, right?
There are.
Yeah.
Byte array is how it is referred to in PostgreSQL. There are different ways of doing large object. You can have a large object, you know, linked, but then it's on the file system and it's not really in the database. But I also wonder about just getting this, getting that metadata by running arbitrary programs against it. That is not really feasible if you have the MP3 in a byte array field. How do you run file on it? How do you run?
You put it on the file system and do it. Yeah, I see what you're saying. So what you're saying is like mutating the file on the file system allows other applications. It's like it's almost an interface.
Right. A file store is a form of database. It's just not a relational database. So
what you're saying is a file header and the system itself is
a database. Yeah, inode information, that's all a database.
Sure.
It's just it's one specifically for file management.
And since these are files, it kind of makes sense.
And you're not relating them to something else. They're not a relational database structure where you're I think there is value in that. And I think there's also value in having the application layer be able to just talk to the database and say what's going on with the system. Have the web server be able to just look at the file system and say that file's there, I'm going to serve it.
Right.
Which is very fast, pulling it from the database
So what's happening right now, of course, is there's actually a data entry that's called like episode, and then from there there's like episode audio relational table to that. And if that that relation exists, then you get an MP3 file served from the XML. Or MP3 URL, I should say. But when you then try to access that URL, it might not be on the file system. It might be on the file system. Hopefully it is. If not, we've got a 404. But the point is that the database doesn't – like the database has a lie, right? The database has an entry that says something's there.
And there are a lot of lies in our database right now.
You know, pull requests welcome.
There are a lot of files also that are of just really varying format. I mean – you can't look at the files, the image files that are on the file system, the teaser images and stuff like that, and get a coherent structure. Like the file names are all different.
Right.
And part of that was by design. Like you made it so that the file name was in the database, but it becomes like, wait, you have to look in the database to find out which file you're going to look at. And one of the things about this setup is like it gives you an incentive to make the file look a certain way.
Yeah.
Like you make the file a certain name and you're done. You don't need that linking anymore.
Well, I mean, the whole idea of the file
make them more regular, the way I want to say it.
Yeah, one of the files that we have for almost all shows, well, in the last 4 years of every show, is called a teaser. And basically it's kind of a synopsis, it's that quad image that you see on the podcast and such. And that image always has the same derived name structure. But the other ones are ones where we upload the file. And the file should have a descriptive name that represents what to be found. But I didn't implement anything to name those files. I just said, well, you know, geeks are smart. They can name the files the correct way and then upload them. But unfortunately, we have a lot of like nd51.jpg. And no one knows what that is without looking at the database. And of course, the link is in mtext, which is kind of like a textile. So I was going to ask you something about Markdown You know what Markdown is, right?
Markdown is the markup language used for GitHub.
Yeah.
It's so, also, yes, I'm familiar with it now.
Now you're familiar with it. It was actually created by John Gruber, the guy that runs Daring Fireball. He's got a great podcast, too, about tech. In any case, he made Markdown early on, and Markdown basically is a text you can read by hand that then gets translated into HTML for
Wait,
you.
Does Markdown actually predate mText?
I don't know.
If I had actually published mText, how far would it have gone? No.
Markdown. There's quite a few of them. I don't know what the timeline is. I don't know what timeline of mText is either.
Initial release 2004. So yes, mText is older.
Dude, seriously? Now, okay, first off, mText is the name I gave to Miles's text language, and M stands for Miles. And basically, the thing that was very different about mText versus Markdown.
I agreed to mText. You wanted me to call it Miles text.
Okay.
And that was a bridge too far for me.
Yeah, yeah. So anyway, the thing that about your document language was it actually looks a lot like Markdown. There's a lot of wiki syntax type of things, mm-hmm. and I call them wiki syntax because they kind of emerge at the same time. Text that you write in a certain formatted way that then gets translated to another form. Markdown translates text and textile, which is the one we actually use on the system right now, translates the text you write into HTML, and that's by design. So there's a tag that says this is going to be an emphasized tag or a bold tag, and this is going to be a headline. mText actually created structured, what kind of document?
It was a semantic document. It was DocBook.
DocBook. It created DocBook structures. So it was, and we never used DocBook except for as a translation layer. So clearly much more advanced and a lot harder to use and implement. We still have a whole bunch of mText on the site. In fact, I never translated it. So if you go like look at the WAS entry, it's all this crap because we're trying to take mText and translate it with textile, and it's not the same language. So you
and
see
mText is written in Java, which I didn't port to any other language. And yeah, it's... wait, I did. I did have an mText processor in JavaScript.
Why do you get that?
And I could hunt down the code, but I'm thinking it might be just more time efficient to rewrite it.
Why don't you write an mText and textile translation to Markdown? Because Markdown won. The thing about the system we use now is you can put HTML in our pages. You can like do iframes in our pages, and it works. Not good structure. Very bad. Oh, so Markdown. So you know what Markdown is?
Yes.
With this system, couldn't you read Markdown files with Postgres using your little tool and then do a live translation of them into HTML?
Because
a lot of people write their blogs in Markdown.
Not really. The idea behind the foreign data wrapper is you're writing it as a tabular structure. Markdown and others like it are hierarchical.
Mm-hmm.
And so the hierarchical data types in PostgreSQL are things like JSON.
Or XML.
Or XML. And so I guess it could be converted to an XML type, but then you're not in a tabular format. You're bringing back a table with a single XML column.
I wasn't thinking about structuring it that way. What I'm talking about more is the idea of like bringing Postgres into like the front end server aspect. Like you take Apache or Nginx and Postgres, and together you have everything you need to render web pages.
Well, yes.
That's the secondary project you're working on.
I don't mean it as putting it in the front end because it's in the exact same position that it has always been in for 99% of the sites out there. I just get rid of the middleman.
Right. So but what I was saying is that a lot of people have directories of Markdown files and they're serving that with some processing that then uploads them as HTML. So I can't remember all the names of these tools. Jekyll is the Ruby version of this. There's a Node variant as well that does the same type of thing. It's basically called a static site generator, right? So you have your raw files, and then you push a button, and you create an HTML web page, and you upload those via FTP, SFTP, whatever, to a server, and then you have no processing on the server. So I was just thinking that since you have that structure, and you could just take Nginx and Postgres, and with those raw files, you could be rendering the site on the fly. It's compelling to me because I like Markdown.
There is a Markdown implementation in Lua. So all you would need actually is Nginx.
So Nginx for the Lua processing, and then
Nginx to cache.
No, the reason why you'd want the database is that you could say, "Give me all the titles of the state range."
Yes,
things like that, where the database could be consuming. It's like you wouldn't need anything else, and you'd have like an indexable site that would work you know, for navigation stuff. Anything else? Your code? Any other technical things? This is a technical episode. Is there anything else?
Yeah, I haven't backed up my laptop in 18 days.
Do you back up to Google, or what do you back up with?
Time Capsule.
What are you running your Time Capsule on? Is it like on a hard, just a standard hard drive, or a NAS, or what?
You mean Time Machine?
Sorry,
it's a Time Capsule.
Oh, it's an Apple Time Capsule.
Yeah, you paid the it was bucks. Originally a 500 gigabyte, and I put a 3 terabyte drive into it.
I've been interested in NASs and use that as my data storage for a long time, network attached storage devices, because long ago when we had Drew on the show and he worked at Infront, which was then bought by
Netgear.
ReadyNAS was the product that they have, still called ReadyNAS, I think, by Netgear. We had these units and we were using them, and so I kind of got into the idea of like a network attached storage. But I have to say that I have never felt like I really like them. I now have a Drobo 5N, which I got as a demo to talk about on the show, basically, and then filled it with my own drives, and I've been using that. Not the best solution. Right now, I'm having a lot of slowness in connecting to it. I think it's my network, and so I'm actually getting new APs.
Something
for this.
I found, commercial NASs, unless you're spending a fair amount of money, just aren't fast. I've looked at a lot of them, and I'm like, they're getting 30 to 50 megabytes a second, and I'm like, that's just not fast enough.
So I'm definitely at this point, like I definitely have a desire to have a better solution for my backups. Like I want my data to flow fast. I don't want to be sitting waiting. I feel like if I have a regular place, I go, that's where I charge my computer at home. Mm-hmm. And when I do that, I plug in a USB drive and, fire up Carbon Copy Cloner or some other tool like that. The faster that is, the more likely I'll have backups consistently because I'm home every night. Like having it attached doesn't.
Well, one, you want to have the network running fast. So you want to have 802.11 AC, with multiple antennas.
Yes.
So those devices that are saying like the AC 1900s or 1750s.
Right. I'm getting the one I'm getting is got four antennas in it, if you will.
And make sure that you can read that from the other side, like your laptop can do that. Many of them can't. Many of them, even if they're AC compatible, will only be compatible with like a single stream rather than three simultaneous streams.
I thought the simultaneous was really about two APs talking to each other. I thought all the endpoint devices weren't. It's more about like I've got a family of five.
No, you can get endpoint devices that do multiple streams.
Oh, right. All right. Via USB.
Yeah.
But see, that's the thing is like if I'm going to plug an external Wi-Fi access point to USB so that I can get access to my data, why not just have a drive bay sitting there that I plug in?
Yeah. Or for that matter, if you're going to do that dongle, like especially if you were always sitting in the same spot, why not just have a hard connection where you have Ethernet going in?
Because Ethernet goes up to, I don't know.
That's the funny part is Ethernet goes 1 gigabit per second.
Yes. If you've got good cables. Yeah. My house is wired with not 5E, right? So I've got 100 megabit. The cables are short. Okay. I might be able to push it higher, but in any case.
But it's funny when you look at the Wi-Fi specs, when they say like, 1900 megabits per second. It's like, no, you're not going
to get
that.
You never get that, no.
If the gigabit connection is going to be best. You're doing well.
Okay, so right now, what would you get for a data store? Like I want like 8 terabytes and I want it fast. See, a NAS is the right solution.
It depends on how much you're spending. Yes, a NAS as a technology is the right one. Which one you get, or if you set it up yourself.
Well, I'm not happy with ReadyNAS. I'm not happy with Drobos. Right? Like I haven't seen one. Like now, one way to do it is just build my own box, right? Because then I can put the right mix in.
Synology makes good ones, but at the same time, it's a question of how much money are you willing to spend. The base level model ain't that good. If you're spending a few $100 more, it's like, yeah, you can get something good, but you're spending that much more.
Yeah.
So I always have this like do-it-yourselfer in my head. Like I know how it works. Come on, that's just
the do-it-yourselfer does show its ugly head when you're frustrated with what's happening. Like I mean, literally, when I resoldered the USB micro connected B micro thing all back on, I'm like, well, this is actually okay. The case that I had, there's no way for me to use that, modify that to reinforce that micro connector. But if I made a larger like box for this drive situation with wood, right, because it's the form that I'd be able to sculpt effectively, I could actually embed the connector in the case so that you'd have to unscrew the case, take the cable off, and then I'm not straining that point, right? So then the case becomes more effective. But if it's wood, then I've got a heat problem. So I got to do some plates of metal, then might as well add a fan. Like all this work, it's like, you know what? I'll just pull the drives out of that thing and I'll plug it into some other enclosure. But the thing is, what enclosure? Like
Yeah. With a NAS, if you're going off of gigabit,
yeah,
you're getting, after the overhead, you know, mm-hmm. Stuff like that, if you get 100 megabytes a second, you're doing well.
Seriously?
Yeah. 1 gigabit divided by 8, you get gigabytes. So that's 125 megabytes per second.
I'm pretty sure.
You're going to get overhead on that. So.
Yeah. So what, you think like a NAS, just buy a good one like a Synology one? I mean, I do hear good things about Synology, but I don't know if they're any good.
See, I like the idea of having something that can do 10 gigabits a second and getting some type of adapter.
What are you going to get for your computer?
USB, my USB 3.0 does 5 gigabits per second. It's already faster than the Ethernet.
So doesn't it make sense to get a RAID-type enclosure that does not have a network port and just has a USB port on it? That seems like a pretty good solution. I mean, it's true that you have to be kind of in the same room with you.
No, I would like to. I'd lay down the Ethernet,
but you're still not going to get as good at the three port as the 3.1 USB.
Yes, you will if you get a 10 gigabit adapter to go to the 5 gigabit, which means that you're limited to 5 gigabits per second.
Can you get Cat 5 some form to 10 gigabit?
Cat 6.
Cat 6 can be 10 gigabit.
Yeah. Cat 6A will be even better for that.
But
Cat 6 is
investment
enough.
And cost, right? Like now you're talking about the time and energy to rewire and get the dongle for your computer and get the device that can handle it. Now, if you're going to do the NAS with a 10 gigabit, you're going to get your own NIC, you're going to get your own enclosure, you're building a computer that's going to be on all the time that has all these drives in it. And then you got to run some Linux derivative that's going to do your raiding for you. Or you're going to do hardware raid.
Oh, no, I do it software.
Because then if the hardware fails, you're not totally screwed.
I don't think that hardware RAID makes a difference anymore. You do want to have battery backup on your drive. If you have battery backup or UPS on the system and you have battery backup on the drives themselves so that their write buffers can go to the disk, then I don't see the need to have hardware RAID. They just don't perform better.
Yeah. Okay, so let me ask you this. What if I get like an old Mac? Like I got a Mac like yours kind of, but it's a little smaller than that. And so it's not like – it's a totally functional machine. We're not using it very much right now. Mm-hmm. It's got kind of – it's. I think its hard drive is actually a spinning disk, not a SSD. So take that drive, plug its USB 3.1 into a box that's stupid.
Wait, you have a laptop this old that has 3.1?
It doesn't have 3.1, does it?
It has 3.0.
Okay, 3.0. So a little bit slower connection. But have that be then a RAID a box that's hardware RAID but not a NAS with USB 3. Output. Mm-hmm. But see, as soon as you do that, if anything goes wrong with the box, you don't have that data because the hardware itself constrains your, you know, its life. But in any case, then you use your laptop as the UPS, because you're gonna have a lot of drives, so you need another power supply. But UPS, but your laptop as the your server, right? So then you connect to that to get the file share. You make that available to outside resources, and it's got gigabit Ethernet. Doesn't that seem like a pretty cheap, nice solution?
If you already have the laptop, sure. Otherwise, that's a really expensive way to do that.
No, an old laptop is not that expensive. $500, $300.
Yeah, but a non-laptop with a mini ITX motherboard.
$250. With a fully loaded, you're right. Yes. With 10 gigabit Ethernet.
It is a modern CPU and, more RAM.
And you have to have for the hard drives anyway, you have to have a UPS. So UPS is off that machine as well. Okay. Are you at all interested in building this hardware thing? Because if we build it in parallel, it'll be a lot cheaper.
This is a question
of
time.
A lot easier. I know it's a question of time. We have kids and we've got jobs. But I want this so bad. I don't. I'm sick of being stressed about my data. Okay, so then you go to a service, but a service is no good because
a service. Then you're going through your internet connection.
I know.
Even slower.
Well, except that I can bring my stuff to work. I've got a good connection at work. That's not a problem. But it's frustrating. Yeah, I do want it local. I want my stuff local. The other thing I want to do though is I want to duplicate my NAS. At a different location.
Okay. I'm going to do my Joan Rivers impersonation. Can we talk? Now, right now, there is no easy way, like there used to be, to archive stuff for the consumer. Just there isn't. You have hard drives that are 8, 10 terabytes.
Yeah.
You can get them, and they're
and any archives people have are on CDs and DVDs, which are failing. They fall apart. They fail.
But you can get M-Disc CD or DVDs and Blu-ray. So you can get archival quality discs that are a reasonable price compared to the other media. The problem is you can't get that media in the sizes that approach what the hard drives are.
Right, right. Okay, here's your 2 terabyte drive. Save that to CDs.
Yeah,
DVDs.
Save it to Blu-ray. Like the Blu-ray discs just by themselves, like the 25 gigabyte ones, like 25 gigabytes divided into 2 terabytes.
That's a lot of Blu-rays. And the write speed is not fun.
That's like, what, 80 discs?
Yeah, and the write fun. And if you want to get data off
Write speed is not an issue. This is archival. We're talking about you get it on there and this is for the long term.
Yeah, but the data and stuff. But also all those Blu-rays, they cost money and then you have to make sure you have a Blu-ray player forever.
The 25 gig, that's just too small. So you look at the BDXLs, you look at the 50, the 100s, and those are ridiculous in price. They're ridiculous.
No, you just buy hard drives. But the thing is, you have to have hard drives run. You can't just put them in a box. So you're basically talking about you've got to maintain your data on drives, and you have to – it needs to be like a lease process.
Why do you need to have them running? Sorry, I need
– Do you have hard drives sitting around somewhere?
I got plenty of hard drives sitting around somewhere.
Got data on any of them?
Who knows?
Exactly. That's why. Because you didn't label them and you don't know how many copies you have. And it's the software management
almost
of the data.
All of them, because
the
hard drives have grown so fast. In general, when I got a new hard drive, just copy the whole thing. Yeah, just copy
the whole thing.
Because that new drive is already like 4 times
Except
the size.
That if your solution is a NAS, which is kind of slow to process through and look through, you don't know how much data you have on there. And you have a copy of the stuff on a whole drive, but now you don't have like the serial interface. You can't run a desktop. Like, I don't currently have a desktop computer.
You're talking about NASs as like these 4 hard drive monstrosities. I'm not even talking about
that. I'm saying that's a problem that emerges. But the biggest problem about the archiving is actually the index of the archive. When I say the index of our hard drive, meaning like being able to access the data from the archive at some point, or knowing if you have a copy of the archive, or what state the archive is in, all those things are best to be managed by some software,
or the file system, ZFS and BetterFS.
That's the software I'm talking about.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, that's the other thing about these NAS is the file systems are not in good. So I have files that like the hard drive that I was recovering from, and the hard drive, the NAS that I was copying to. Mm-hmm. I was copying like they were the same. They were mirrored. Everything was fine with them. And I'm copying them, and you know, overnight, 50 gigabytes got transferred. I'm like, what's that? What the – those are the same files. Why are the data being – oh, it's because one of them's corrupted.
Yeah, every time I'm
one
doing –
one of the files corrupted. Yeah, I don't know which one.
After 1 week, I will go, if I'm doing like 1 week in between time capsule backups,
yeah,
I go back, and it's like backing up 6 gigabytes. And I'm like, 6 gigabytes?
Exactly.
Like, even if I created, like, 2 virtual machines.
Okay, so clearly, Miles, you and I are not business people. Because clearly, we actually have the problem space. We know it pretty well. We're good communicators. We've been doing software for a long time. Clearly, this is a business process, a business that we could generate, you know, we could do. But we're not going to
do
that.
You want to get into the hardware business?
No, not a hardware problem. Because the hardware is cheap and easy. It's a software problem. It's the management's a software problem. I think.
Yes. I mean, there's software packages like FreeNAS. The software problem has been solved by a lot.
But the NAS just gives you the file system. You need – there's
– No, FreeNAS like has – look up FreeNAS. Like, they have a lot of this stuff.
Okay. So the photo archive I use is Lightroom, right?
Mm-hmm.
Lightroom is an extremely nice application in the sense that I can find my files pretty easily, right? That doesn't exist for – generic file system files.
They can if you use my database file system tool with specific programs that are called against it.
Well, that's kind of why I bring it up, right? Because you have a system that's scraping the system and making a database for it, right? So you just need like 12 other tools to then reorganize the files to be cleaned up, get rid of duplicates, because of course you can detect that. The index, like, it becomes a project that would be kind of awesome. that I don't want to do.
Yeah, I keep thinking of, like, you have a NAS and you want to do an archive. You need to have more than one copy of it. But, man, are syncing tens of terabytes?
No, right. So you and I both build hardware boxes that have, like, 10 terabytes, okay? Mm-hmm. I don't need 10 terabytes. I only need 4. You only need 4, right?
I don't even need that.
Then we get in the same room with the gigabits. We copy each other's data. But when we copy it, we encrypt it. But then you and I, our systems will keep in sync. So if my house burns down, you've got to copy my stuff or vice versa.
Right. But how fast are you copying that? 50 megs a second?
No. When you get together and have a little party and you plug in.
Yeah. Plug in so that you can plug into gigabit Ethernet, which gives you a maximum 100. Of 100 megs a second.
It takes a while. But what else are you going to do?
That's what I mean by something like ZFS. ZFS does rsync and like the initial copy.
But the copy gets together and then in sync. Yes.
But the sync after the fact? Because ZFS does checksums on the files.
This is the other thing that's so frustrating is that my NAS, which is my definite storage place, does not have ZFS, right?
Yeah.
So files get corrupted. Yep. That just happens. Like, no, that's the whole point.
Like, no, I want
to. I don't want it to go corrupted.
I want to know that something's wrong. I want it to have some parity so you can repair it.
Waking up in the morning and seeing like 50 gigabytes transferred of two systems that were mirrored. Man, that pissed me off. I'm like, and the thing is, I haven't lost anything because I have one of them is probably good, right?
Well, it's kind of Heisenberg right now.
Right. The files we're dealing with, of course, there's the archive of Geekspeak, which, you know, every week we record an hour and I record WAV files and, you know, I make a lot of data from Geekspeak. Mm-hmm. And so,
well, a lot.
I have probably less
600
than
600 to a gig per week.
Yes. 17 years.
And how many terabytes are drives now? Like,
yeah, no, it's not a lot. I mean, that's the thing is my photo archive is, you know, pushing 2.5 terabytes, right? But my
the raw photos are far more than any one of these episodes in uncompressed format.
I feel like we're under half a terabyte
now,
for Geekspeak.
There's also no reason why you have to have WAV files as opposed to FLAC files.
I know. You know, if I had the software to transform them, I would, just to save the data, obviously. But, I mean, I don't even need the WAV files. The MP3s are done, right? Who cares? We don't need the extra files. But data's cheap.
It's nice to have the originals. These are good quality mics. It's good to have the originals. As we talk about the original CD-ROM drives, we can actually have a DVD-R.
We didn't rip all the CDs, right? We've got tons of CDs. The CD archive that we have for the first 5 years of the show, when you grabbed that, all you did is grab the copies that we didn't have on the website already, right?
No, they were all just old stuff. Like I basically have everything up until 2003 or 2004.
But those came from the CDs?
Yeah. And the DVDs, yeah.
And the DVDs?
Yeah.
Oh, was I burning the DVDs?
Yeah.
Okay, but
Thank goodness.
Did you get all of those files off?
Yeah.
Okay, good. Can I get a copy of that at some point?
What are you talking about? I gave the disc back to you.
No, I don't want the CDs and DVDs. If you ripped them already, I want to get files. Jerk.
What, man? The thing is, they're in really random order. There are a lot of duplicates.
You dated them, right?
They were
files.
Yes.
Mostly files.
Yeah. And the files do have dates on them. The dates are all in different like formats. You have like some of them that it's the prefix, some of them it's the suffix. Some of them we had bad recordings, okay, so there's like part one, part two.
Over a year and a half ago, you and I decided that we'd go away from the date-based and go to episodic.
Mm-hmm.
So we used to have the shows based off of date.
Mm-hmm.
And then we were like, let's switch to episodic. So you at some point were like, and I'm working on this new tool and stuff. And I was like, okay. And you're like, I'm making a better schema because your schema is Rails-based and it totally blows. I'm like, yeah,
no,
whatever.
It's really Rails-based. Easy. It wasn't the reason why it blows.
Yeah, it is. I didn't invent the schema. Rails invented the schema. It's developed by Rails. That's what the schema came from.
Yeah.
You understand that, right? Like migrate, add table. Like it doesn't index because Rails didn't index it. Like,
yeah, sometimes you got to take responsibility for it.
Oh my God, I'm going to murder you.
I used this tool and the tool did something bad. It's not my fault. It's the tool. Who chose the tool?
Yeah, but
I didn't choose Rails. I didn't choose Active Record.
I didn't say that it wasn't me that chose the tool, but I did build the site, and I used Rails. And so the schema that came out is the default schema. Oh, my God. Kill you. So, any case, I lost my train of thought there. So we decided to change the show to episodic. Mm-hmm. So for the last year and a half, the entry of the show is not today's date is blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. It's episode 31 of season 17, whatever.
Because we might not be weekly anymore, except we're basically
keep on being weekly. Yeah. But we did that mostly because also the date started to flux a bit. We know we're doing them weekly, but we didn't always. But then we got on the radio again, so now we have a date again that's clearly the published date, right? Because it's on the broadcast. So the thing is, because you were like, oh, we should save the number, the index of the episode season should be in this format that you invented for this new schema, which is great and everything, but I didn't port that over to Rails. It's just an idea right now that you implemented. So what I've been doing so that we have the data is in the body of the doc, I've been putting the episode number in a form that's kind of the same every week, which I've been doing for like a year and a half. Instead of taking the hour it would take to add the friggin' fields to Rails. Like, it literally would take me an hour and a half to add episode and season. But it wouldn't be structured well, and you'd give me a hard time on the schema. So I'm not doing it.
But see,
and every week I type
give you a hard time
in E31S17.
But I'm giving you a hard time on the schema either way. You're screwed either way. You might as well.
It's a year and a half of me typing these friggin' numbers for like – and then I've got to
– now, something we do need to work out is are we ever – can we just like disallow – saying, oh, we recorded this one, but we forgot to actually put it into the system. Because then the numbers would get screwed.
Dude, if the show happened, it has an episode number. You have to deal with that. You're like always going, oh, well, we have 700 episodes. That's the episode number. No. There was an episode. We have no recording of it. We don't know what we talked about, but it aired that day. Mm-hmm. That thing has a number. You can't erase things. It's not cool.
I'm not talking about erasing things. I'm talking about we didn't have one.
Okay, Miles.
Anyway.
If you and I right now started a brand new show called Annoying Geek Speak. Because I think the audience feels that way right now. So
we have an audience right now?
Not,
everyone's
not
bailed out long
we used
before
to.
Then.
So we have episode 0, and then we have episode 1, and then we have episode 2. And I don't write – I don't do anything with episode 2. Don't even record it. But we record it.
Yeah.
But it – you know, it was just broadcast in Boulder Creek and it never goes on the podcast or anything. And then we have episode 4. Can you name episode 4 and episode 3? No. Because there was episode 3. You can't do that. You can't just remove it. So you're just like, oh, well, we don't have a copy of it and it was 7 years ago. So
that's
forget
not what
it.
No, that's what not what I'm saying.
So what are you saying?
I was talking about if we recorded something – because we've done this before. We recorded something like, we're not going to use that right now. We're going to record something else. And then you still have that. But that information inside of it may be dated.
If we never release the episode, if it's never been listened to an audience, it's done. That's not an episode.
Okay. And it will never be.
No. But
or
if
rather,
anyone...
it will never be an old one. Like we may go like,
no,
oh,
no,
this
we
is
we might
a,
take
it...
and go, here's some old footage, blah, blah, blah. But then and, that's the new episode.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
But if we aired it. If the audience heard it, it's a number.
If it's been aired, I'm totally on board with you. That's not what I was saying. I was talking about the things that we recorded and never actually aired.
Why would we do that? Why do we do that? Like the conversation we have right now?
Who knows?
All right, let's out. Thank you, man. That was fun.
Yep, indeed.
All right, that was a geeky version of Geek Speak. If you like that, give us feedback. Let us know you enjoy it, and we'll make them every once in a while. What the heck? Miles and I like to talk about tech. Geek Speak is registered service marker. David Lawrence is user permission, and Geek Speak is Creative Commons Attribution 3.0. Use their stuff any way you like. Just let them know we made it. Theme song is by Michael Newman of Pet Star Music. Today's title is, I don't know. What's today's title? This new one we just did.
All your database are belong to us.
Miles, thanks for doing that with me. That was fun.
Always a pleasure.